Thank you, Margie. Now we'll move to the Q&A portion, and we have Mike Field joining us on the webinar, along with 84 other people. We also have Natalie Scarrett and Anna Gibson from DFID joining us. Please wait for us to pass you the microphone. It's important that our webinar audience can hear. So I know the whole room can hear you without the microphone, but we want everyone to hear. And we'll start with one question from the webinar audience. We will start with one question in the room. Oh, and please state your name and affiliation before answering or before asking.
I'm Dan Norell from World Vision, and this is a question for Mike Field, but maybe Margie Brandt would also like to respond. In terms of the village agent model, Mike, if you could give the audience just some understanding of the money flow of that, how the project, any project funds that go to the agro dealers, is there any incentives, is it just training, and then also in terms of how the money flows between the agro dealers and the village agents. So Mike, if you could first respond to that, and then Margie, if you have any follow-up to that.
Sure. Hi Dan, how are you? Good to hear you again. So what we're doing with the village agent is, essentially this is not a particularly new concept. When you have essentially social networks that are pretty tight, as Margie explained, sometimes in retail in the history you've kind of tried to figure out ways to interject or include that network as part of your network. And that's what this is essentially about trying to do. So the agents really come from a conversation between the input firm and the community about who they would trust in terms of being almost a private extension officer that would also then provide a way of bulking the order so it would be cost-effective for farmers to get access to inputs in a way that they couldn't normally do if they were trying to buy, you know, travel, again, like Margie said, travel quite a distance to get to the town. In Kenya, where I've done this before in Zambia and it's worked well, in Kenya where there's a little bit more density of population, in areas where the market days are there, then we're suggesting to the retailers not to use this and to rather use the foot traffic at market days. But in areas where there's more, it's more rural and market days are less, more sporadic, I would say, the agents are starting to form. The general kind of process is the agent gets identified between the input firm and the community. The input firm takes the agents that have been identified, gives them some training. We help the firm, the agro-vet or agro-dealer, essentially develop the training that's more appropriate for those types of individuals, sometimes maybe a little bit more experiential-based learning and less kind of reading and writing kind of learning, if you'd say that. And then from there, they come up with an agreement on the commission. We don't really provide any support in terms of the commission. At times, depending on what the specifics are, we have worked with agrovets to push certain products or certain new advances in technology, whether that's certain types of seeds, certain types of chemicals available, certain types of fertilizers. In that case, we sometimes cost share promotions, but we don't really focus in on subsidizing the agent network, really, other than helping with training.
Sometimes supporting a staff person within an agro-dealer firm who might, part of their role might be to manage the agro-dealer network. So they might be a cost share and a staff person, decreasing cost over a year's period, but that they can realize that that's an inherent support service or service or a job function that's needed within that entity.
No. Yes? There we go. Hi. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. My name is Marcella Willis. I work with the Payment Innovations team at NetHope. And along the lines of the money flows, I have a question. I imagine there are a lot of cash payments flowing around between the farmers and the suppliers and the buyers. And in terms of facilitating business processes, I was wondering if there is any Are you using mobile money and electronic payments for that? And if so, what has been the impact, both negative or positive? And also, has it been difficult to get users to adopt using mobile money? And can you recommend any types of tools or resources on training for user adoption?
Mike, do you want to address that? So as they're bringing Mike in, and I would like Mike to address this, Dar, tell us when you...
Fireside is the pace of which payment comes. And the mobile systems have been very helpful. You know, some what are relatively good supply chains for smallholders to get in, the supplier doesn't have the cash flow or the mechanism to pay right away. So once they start using mobile money and can pay right away, the farmers feel more confident and more willing to stay loyal, if you want to say. In certain cases that we've seen where they haven't gotten paid right away, even though the general relationship is solid, they've kind of moved back because they have cash flow requirements. So they tend to sometimes move away from them and even will sometimes side sell to other people who come with payment more immediately. So that sometimes has been a really help for us. There's a lot of efficiencies, obviously, in mobile money that we've seen throughout the chain to the real retail sector. We are pushing actually the mobile money to be a main kind of driver of how exchange happens. There's a lot of issues with holding cash in the communities. There's also ways for us to then take advantage of the cash flows more explicitly because we'll be able to track them better so we can start figuring out how to then include things like insurance, include things like discounts, wind things up in different ways promotionally that allows for just a lot more efficiency. Even things like savings and prepayments, layaway payment plans, all that stuff can be more easily applied once we get the mobile money platforms more in place.
And some of the agri-vets, for example, who weren't using mobile money, after being interacting with the promotional days in rural areas and also through the agents, are now setting up mobile money systems because they realize that's a way that it doesn't have to be this cash exchange and they can actually be paid directly by a farmer entity with simply these others acting as the sort of marketing or distribution along the way.
We're going to take two questions from the webinar really quickly.
Hi. Let's see. We've got one question that two folks are interested in, Charles Steinfeld from Michigan State University and Waleed Ahmed, who's with BRAC. Their question is, we hear a lot of market information systems to connect farmers to buyers like M-Farm or Essico. How do these types of systems interact with your project? And for a second question, David Fisher says, great presentation. Can you provide some information on any public sector civil society partnerships to support sustainability of the interventions after the project ends?
Mike?
So I'll take the first one. The issue about market information systems, we would say we have a very different opinion on that. So we think that market information and the ability for people to consume that information and use it effectively really has to be in person, person to person, or through systems that are essentially found on more trusted networks. We've not really found, at least I've not certainly found, and from what we're seeing on the ground and from additional research that's come in, there's kind of impersonal information systems where somebody kind of gets a text message that a price is somewhere, 50 kilometers away, is better than the one that's 10 kilometers away. It hasn't really affected a lot of behavior change because the underlying social networks, the trust levels and input firms and suppliers are so weak, the information and the ability to use that information with an appropriate level of risk isn't there. So what we've done is we've worked with similar types of systems, because in technically similar types of systems, SMS and other things, and push and pull set of SMS, but we do it through as a tool to build the relationships, to build the business relationships, build the business-consumer relationships, and then also as a way to track information that makes those relationships more durable and valuable to the people participating in them. And that's kind of how we've looked at that, that kind of component.
Mike, do you want to speak to some of the public sector partnerships?
Sure. As Margie said, the program is kind of large, so we're dealing with a lot of public sector partnerships even when we're looking at the water industry. I don't know if we want to get into that too much. But from the input industry, one of the areas that we're looking at in terms of partnerships is the regional agricultural officer. We actually think that that may be a key person, kind of relational person, to manage disputes. And now we're doing a little bit more research on whether or not we instill some mediation capacity in that person that we can manage or head off a lot of disputes. Kind of as Margie mentioned, one of the things we're seeing is that a lot of disputes don't get handled effectively. And as a result, they kind of lead to an animosity that goes into the next set of transactions. So you're almost a rolling set of disputes. And so we're seeing mediation as potentially a way to kind of minimize those disruptions. And even to some extent, what could lead into what we're calling small C, kind of disputes, rather to larger C, actual physical conflict, especially as we head in the arid lands where resources are a lot tighter. A lot of these animosities from, you know, years of disputes that haven't got settled, since you can boil into more physical conflict. So we're seeing that as a way that the market system should work better in terms of managing conflict that could essentially boil up to physical conflict in times of stress.
Hi, this is Bill Grant from DAI. Hi, Mike. How are you doing? Margie, very good presentation.
How are you doing?
Good. You know, I think you've really brought out the complexity of the transactions between the retailers and the farmers and all the different issues that come into play in there. And, you know, we know Kenya is perhaps 10 years, 20 years ahead of most other countries. You know, I'm working in Nigeria and Ethiopia. We're far behind. I mean, a lot of these issues you're talking about, foundations were laid by previous DFID projects, the BSMDP, back in the mid-2000s. But if you look at that myriad of problems and issues, to help simplify and, you know, not lose the practitioners in too much detail, which would you say are the two or three most important elements to focus on? Just to reinforce that message back as to what are the most important things that we should be looking at rather than the 16 different interventions you're doing, which is more than most of us could even figure out how to do. Thanks.
Great. Mike?
I think with this, there has been a sequencing, and this may help to kind of set how we prioritize. The first is to try to get the agri-vet and the farmer to see that they actually are important to each other. And from the agri-vet's perspective, it's the sale. So we kind of sequenced our interventions around promotions first and promotions in the community so that the agri-vet was making an investment into the farmer and to the farmer community as almost a trust investment, we'd say. And we sequenced that specifically so we could try and build some bond with the retailer and the farmer, on which then the agri-vet would see the value of investing in business improvements so that he could continue to essentially build on that initial relationship investment he's making. So I think that's probably the key. Without that foundational relationship or foundation or starting off of the foundation of their relationship on something that's mutually beneficial, I'm not sure if we just went in and looked at an IT thing on inventory, for example, as a starting point, we'd get much traction. Because a lot of the value add of those businesses has been based on their initial interaction with the smallholders and seeing that it's a really good market, and then needing the tools to make that market work for them.
And I think a key piece is also, you know, when you look at some of those examples that I showed, they seem like these disparate activities all over the place, is recognizing that many of these are simply sharing an idea and connecting the various entities and maybe subtly building capacity in a particular way and seeing where the energy lies, which firms, which entities are moving ahead with those and kind of moving with them, rather than saying, you know, doing this piece in its entirety, making sure it works, and then going to the next piece. So I think a lot of it is about making the introductions, sharing the ideas, laying the foundations. Mike and his team spend a lot of time meeting with people, whether it's existing franchise operations in Kenya that are franchise operations running in the input supply sector, or whether it's various firms or networks of firms and talking about the potential to do something differently in this way and maybe trying something small and sort of seeing where that energy goes rather than really trying to change things that don't want to change. And I think that's also something that's helpful because a lot of these things can be started at the same time. And some of them don't work as well. So maybe let's stop that for a while, start another one. When you find an entity that takes up a different activity, maybe you can sort of bundle in some of those other pieces too in terms of ideas for them to take forward.
Linda Nemec from Accenture. I wanted to ask about, you talked a lot about the social constraints to change. And can you give some examples of how what you're doing has created that motivation for change and overcome those constraints?
Mike, do you want to speak first?
Ooh, okay, yeah. One of the things that we've looked at is how to essentially manage change, especially on the supply chain side, same as supplier side. So one of the things we're seeing, Margie mentioned the one about the friends and family, but another component that we're seeing is that farmers tend not to look at it at change coming from an individual per se in the community. In fact, sometimes something called the lone nut theory, where the person who is the innovator makes a big change and then everybody has to look at them and then jump onto that. It doesn't work as well as what we're seeing because there's some social constraints about how they manage risk where individuality is somewhat frowned upon. So what we're looking at is how does innovation work when it's not driven by an individual innovator but by groups of people. So, for example, one of the things we're looking at is when promotions are made, rather than try to look for the lead farmer to take on that promotion and be the kind of driving force of change in the community, we're looking at creating a more diffused promotional strategy with multiple demonstrations, if you want, throughout the community so that people have more of a context of this not being so abnormal or being something that this elite person or identified person is the one getting the change, but more accessible. And then the other thing we're doing is we're trying to create more testimonial-based advertising strategies with these firms from the supplier side and also from the retail side so that and this gets into the radio a bit, but using a lot more social networking and communication tools as a way for communities to kind of manage change, think about change, and also see the evidence a little bit more from a trusted source rather than an outside source.
So it's always looking at triangulating the message. So how is the message coming from multiple sources, and how is the demonstration almost coming from multiple sources rather than targeting at one particular place so that you're kind of getting bombarded by mass media with the sources, you're getting bombarded by seeing evidence in your farmers in your community, seeing what's being driven through various dealerships, starting a lot of competitive processes. So how do you put in place competitive processes and use competition for benefit so that you can actually start seeing maybe competition through radio so people can actually be competing on different growing systems or how to pick in different ways or plowing in different ways. And so using competition to actually drive change because you're actually focusing on what are the factors that you believe are good practice. So that I think that's a really powerful system as well.
I'm going to give you three questions from online because we've got quite a few. Natalie Skerritt, who joins us from DFID in London, has a question and also says, many thanks for an excellent presentation, Margie. In a program with so many different activities, I wonder if I could ask a little about live monitoring and implications for management. We know that adaptability, and flexibility are key elements of market systems approaches. How has this worked in practice here? Are there activities that have been less successful and resources redirected? In short, how have you integrated the feedback loops you mentioned? Let me ask one quick other one.
Could we actually focus on that one,
absolutely,
if you don't mind? Sure. Mike?
Sure. There's a couple ways we're doing that. One is tactical, meaning we use this thing we call self-selection. So we present offers, but the offers are really defined in some conditionality of the actors moving first. So this gets back to Margie's sense about tracking energy and momentum in the system and using our support around where the energy is the most positive for change, rather than focusing in on a general offer to everybody and working with everybody in an equal way. We really look towards the people who are driving change to be the ones we use to kind of lead. So there's some conditionality on it. The other is we spend a lot of time kind of setting up M&E systems that track explicitly, but also a lot of ways of framing our interventions around what we call results change, but they're kind of our theory of the process of change will happen and using that as a learning framework for constant conversation. The constant conversation becomes almost the best way to kind of manage that, but you do really need a good learning framework to make the conversations useful. Those are some of the practical ways we're dealing with that.
Gail Motzi from Canadian Hunger Foundation in Ottawa asks, could you please remind me of the total budget and time period for the project? It sounds like a very complex project with a range of activities. Could you speak a bit about how the project is managed and delivered?
Great. Mike, I'll take a stab and you can add to this. The project is approximately 6 years long.
Sure.
It's brought in its second year of operation. It ends in 2017. Converting to dollars, there is about $30 million invested in project activities. The project is managed through an entity called the Kenya Markets Trust, which actually was previously known as the Kenya Gatsby Trust. And part of the project's activity is to strengthen that organization in terms of being able to support market development, learning, and capacity building in the region, even beyond the scope of the project. The project is interestingly divided into sort of different focus areas. So, in other words, staff are actually focused not only on not necessarily on crop-specific areas or value chains, as is often the case in many projects, but rather on cross-cutting areas. So media, for example, is one of the areas that is focused on. The input supply more broadly is another area that's focused on. So supply chain management is another area. So it's really kind of grouping what are similarities in terms of the types of interventions that can really affect change. In that way, and also working obviously with the implementing partners on the ground. Mike, do you want to add a little bit more clarity?
Yeah, that was great. I would give a plug to DFID on this. What they've done is really interesting, I think, in that in conversations here with DFID locally, they realize that there is a concern about taking this approach that essentially recognizes the complexity of the change process in a kind of a shortened time frame that is donor kind of funding explicitly driven. So the local entity, Kenya Markets Trust, is somewhat mission-driven is what we're trying to essentially define it, which is not going to be essentially defined by the specific timelines of any funding source. So there's a set of pooled funders that are coming in to support the organization, and that the programs are not necessarily defined by the funding source, but the funding source is supporting the program so that we can kind of get past the overly shortened timeline that we kind of get caught by in development because of the funding source. So we can look a little bit more strategic about what is the longer-term change process that's needed and set in place the kind of ways to collect evidence so we can make the case that the vision is working, but also make the strategic decisions that probably would be hard to do if we were just on a 2-year or 3-year cycle and then would have to go out and look for more funding.
Hi, Mike Blakely, Nathan Associates. Thank you very much for the presentation. If I understood correctly, one of the key tactics that you've been promoting among the different actors and beneficiaries in the project is this notion of feedback. And I'm wondering if you can, A, give some concrete examples of how you promote that among these people and tactics that they can use to do that, and how that's different from what we might recognize as more traditional market intelligence throughout value chains or things like prices and all that, where the differences lie.
Great. Mike, I'll start in if you can add to that. The promotion is not necessarily around the importance for feedback. So where the various actors may not even realize that that's part of what the intention is. That's kind of our intention in terms of creating systemic change in the system. But the offer, in a sense, in terms of some of the components I spoke about, is what makes better business sense for someone to take on something. So, how does it make better business sense for someone to set up an agent network because they can get revenue in different areas? How do they start that in a very sort of step-by-step, sort of low-risk a low-risk way. But they're not necessarily thinking about it from the perspective that they're getting feedback, that that market signal is flowing. So it's they're not even thinking of it in terms of doing market research. So I think a lot of the activities, we know that that's the ultimate rationale for what we're wanting to put in place, but it's being sold to actors in the market it's far more about why does it make business sense for them to start taking on a specific activity or function. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that was good. I don't know what I have to add other than I think the key here is that for somebody to really use information, they need to think it has value to them. So, like Margie said, we're not essentially trying to go in there and explain our kind of Markham systems language of what we think they should be doing. We're trying to think of what is the business case for them to actually track their customers and know that they're happy. A supplier or a processor that we're working with who has a 20% utility rate for their machinery, they should have a pretty good business case for actually tracking their suppliers, what they're doing, how they're kind of progressing. Managing and forecasting what they think their supply is going to be, and then investing in increasing that supply. So that all becomes feedback from a systemic perspective, but it's key for the business if they're taking a more growth-oriented strategy.
And it's interesting, I'll add one piece there that is, I think, interesting. In terms of the project's M&E system, one of the pieces that the project's looking at is how do you build a capacity without necessarily saying so directly of market actors to collect information about, for example, the farmers in their supply chain or their customers. And they're collecting information about how they're doing, how they're performing. And for example, from the buyer side that we've spoken less about today, how do buyers start recognizing that they would like to incentivize good performance throughout the system? What do they see as being good performance? How do they start recognizing farmers, maybe starting farmers clubs, for example, and rewarding good performance, maybe different types of, you know, high productivity, maybe better quality, whatever it might be, through that system? And how do they start tracking it? Because to be able to reward it, and it makes business sense for them to do it, because then it's less risky for them to invest in those farmers that are performing better, they need to track that information. That is important information that the market itself starts tracking. The project, just by the way, can actually draw on that as part of their monitoring system, so they can actually draw information. But it's not keeping that information just for the project. It's not keeping it for our development purposes. It's actually allowing the market to take ownership of that kind of information so that the market can continually improve, and it's less risky for them to invest or whatever it is, make decisions around it, and then promote good practice in that way, which I think is also something that's really interesting in terms of looking at that.
Hi, I'm Patricia DeVecchio, International Purpose. First, I want to thank you, Margie, for a wonderful presentation. It was just very inclusive, to say the least. And to look at this is really almost a little MBA approach that you have taken on to train the retailers to think out of the mindset of what they've been used to, and to really look at their business as much beyond just the store or the plot of land. And so a question I have is, do you have thoughts of scaling this, and if so, how?
Great. Mike?
Sure. Kind of as we define scale is the ripple effect that Margie talked about. So what we're seeing now is as these businesses start to take the changes, they tend to increase their sales by a bit. As they take that on, we're seeing them essentially affect their sometimes retailers. So the retailer here we're talking about is probably not a micro stockist, but a larger firm that has two or three stores. And they often sell to 50 to 100 more stockists. So what they're starting to do, because they see this working in their three or four stores they own, is they're starting to create almost customer loyalty clubs for their micro stockist, if you want. And then they're starting to essentially create training programs so their micro stockists can start to take on these tactics, if you want, business tactics, as you're saying. And by doing that, we see that along with the kind of competitive pressure that also Margie mentioned is seeing how we're going to get scale.
We talk a lot about business-to-business training. So what's the incentive for one? So rather than having an outside entity providing training, how do you have businesses provide training to other businesses in the sector because it makes business sense for them to do so? So Mike spoke about the retailers providing training to their micro-stockists. Now, that training might be even more broad training than just on the particular piece that they're providing, because they want those microstockers to do better. There's also a big drive with ICT firms. How do the ICT firms provide training to stores, not just on how to integrate their inventory management software, but how do they use that to better their business practices? So understanding what is the business cycle, the business processes that those aggregators, retailers, whatever might go through, and how do they use that software to benefit those business practices, which ultimately is more broad type of training or TA than they would normally be giving. But so a lot of the incentive is looking at how can businesses be incentivized to train others in the system, business-to-business training, to build that capacity in a sustainable way rather than building in an external capacity-building function.
Hello, my name is Antonio Calzada. I'm an independent consultant. Thank you for your presentation. It's been it's wonderful that you have explained so many details regarding your project. And I think regarding the approach that somewhat takes a, kind of like an extension service, puts it in the hands of the private sector to with an economic gain or an economic interest, I think it's a very good approach that's working in a lot of private sector approaches in different countries. And you talked a little bit, a couple of times about the promotion kind of incentive that retailers are providing to the farmers. Could you talk a little bit more about the promotion, maybe how that is working from a financial standpoint for the retailer? And on the other hand, once you're getting all these folks together and getting the retailers in front of the farmers, and then you definitely have a lot of happy farmers as customers, are you utilizing these farmers to sell your product as a retailer, kind of a lead farmer type thing that then passes the word along for you to grow the business?
Right. Often your agents are actually lead farmers, so your agents themselves are known in the community. They can act as lead farmers, so that model works well there. Mike, can you speak a little bit about promotions as a tactic?
Sure. I mean, from a marketing perspective, promotion is just an educational activity. So what we're trying to do is again, from what Margie said before, is we're trying to create what is the business reason for an input firm to essentially communicate and educate farmers. And essentially that's more sales or promotional activity. So what we help the retailer see is that if he actually gets out behind his desk or out of his store and engages his customers, find out what he wants, and provide them with better information so they can make more informed choices about their input purchases or investments, they're going to, in the end, buy more from him. And essentially that's what it is. So the promotional specifics range from innovation promotion, so they're talking about new ideas, of which there may be some discount contest around getting that into the hands of farmers. So we've done a lot of that on soil testing. We've also done some more just general introductory promotions, so the way the input firm goes out to the community, talks to the community about his various programs and products and services he has available, where he doesn't necessarily try to push a specific product, but just try to have understanding what the customer is doing and also create a relationship with him. So there's lots of different types of promotional events, I guess, we're trying to figure out. And that leads into essentially things like trying to get radio stations involved in them, covering them for their own purposes, and using other technologies such as the customer survey tools to essentially follow up on promotions.
I think we might have time for one last question from the webinar.
Hello, this is Yinder Chekhan from Chekhan Consulting. Having worked a lot in rural areas, I'm also curious whether there's a gender distinction here, because women so often have, women farmers that I've worked with, particularly in Africa, have so much less social capital as well as financial capital, access to resources in order to access the inputs. So I'm wondering if you have a different outreach strategy for women farmers, especially given that they're the majority, 80% of food, blah, 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 is produced by them.
Thank you. And Dara, could you, I think the webinar question relates to gender as well, so if you could ask that as well.
A couple of people asked this question about gender. Let me see if I can find it here. Could you please address whether there are any specific gender considerations in your work? Are you doing anything specifically to enhance women-owned businesses or women farmers?
Great. Mike?
Sure. I think some of the things we're doing are more systemic, so they wouldn't necessarily be defined as gender, but we've seen anecdotally that it actually affects women quite a bit. This issue of lack of social capital is a particular one. So a lot of the access to spray services in particular, so if a woman-headed household is going to access spray services, she would have to use her social capital to get in the list or the line to access whatever the spray equipment is in the area, and usually she would be pretty low on that list. So what we're trying to do is professionalize and commercialize spray services so that, you know, anybody who has the cash can essentially pay for it. We're also then, you know, obviously linking in financial service where appropriate. And we're seeing that as actually somewhat a game changer because in a lot of cases, especially when you're talking about vulnerable households, they really don't have the labor to manage the land, but they have the management capacity to probably manage land if they can get the right services that are cost effective for them. That's one side. We're in the middle right now of doing a relatively extensive gender strategy, taking into consideration social norms, political norms, economic issues, what the women are doing in terms of the economic activity, and whether or not there could be ways for us to essentially get them better access, either that through, you know, another woman village agent, for example, that would make it easier for them to interact with them. So we're looking at those dynamics right now, and so we can have a little bit more understanding of what are the kind of limitations. Are they social, cultural? Are they capital, in some ways financial capital? That are limiting the women's participation.
So they actually, the project's looking at both a gender and a youth strategy at the moment in terms of what is being impacted and how to adapt some of the offerings and tactics because of that.
Well, I would like to thank Mike and Margie. Margie for a wonderful presentation and Mike for a wonderful Q&A. Thank you. Also wonderful to have Diffid join us, so that was great. I want to say to you that our contract with QED is ending, and we will have something new eventually. So we'll have a bit of a hiatus, but we hope to see you in about a month. I know this is a very sad way to end. But before that, there is another seminar happening on Tuesday. This is Tetra Tech is sponsoring this, but we are offering the space here for it. And you know, one of the issues that came up today was about flexible and adaptive programming. And so, Engineers Without Borders is going to do this presentation. They've been working with Tetra Tech in Uganda, and they're going to talk about how they've done sort of rolling adaptive programming, which I think is really interesting idea and interesting programming approach for market system development. So anyway, hope to see you all on Tuesday, and other than that, we'll see you in a month or so.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.